From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Trump's chief economic advisor said he thinks Republicans have the votes to pass health care reform. Here's Gary Cohn speaking on CBS.
Do we have the votes for health care? I think we do. This is going to be a great week. We're going to get health care down to the floor of the House. We're convinced we've got the votes, and we're going to keep moving on with our agenda.
And late last night, the House and Senate reached a deal to keep the government funded through September. Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
And do they have the votes on health care?
It's not clear that they do. We have not seen a nose count or a vote count that changes fundamentally from where they were at the end of March. You know that they tried to do this last week by saying confidently they had the votes and here we go and now we're going to the floor. And, well, that didn't happen. We do expect them to make another effort this week. But the question still is, if they brought the House Freedom Caucus on board, that's the most hardcore conservative group, how many votes did they lose in the center in the process?
And how many votes would they lose in the Senate? Because it would have to eventually get through the Senate as well. Now, President Trump created some confusion about the bill yesterday when he said that under the latest version, people with pre-existing conditions would be guaranteed coverage as they are in Obamacare. Here he is in an interview with CBS's John Dickerson.
And one of the fixes that was discussed pre-existing was optional for the states.
Sure. In one of the fixes. And they're changing it.
Oh, okay.
And changing
so it'll be permanent.
Of course.
Okay.
This
well, that's a development, sir.
Ron, there are a lot of health policy experts who say that is not true. That is not in the bill. What do we know about this?
There is language about pre-existing conditions in the bill. Yes, the president's right that there is a clause about it. But the bill also gives the states the option to opt out, to say, no, we would rather have lower premiums and we would rather set up these high-risk pools and we would like to do this and that, but we don't want to grant you the sort of assurance, the guaranteed issue and the essential health benefits package that would cover people with pre-existing conditions. That will be left up to the states, and that means if you happen to live in a state that wants to go that route, many states might, you don't have any assurance of coverage under your pre-existing conditions.
What about the short-term budget that is expected to pass this week? They've reached a deal to keep the government funded through September. When you look at what's in it, it's got more money for the military, no money for the border wall, even though it does have money for border security. It says specifically it can't be used on the wall. No cuts to Planned Parenthood, very little cutting for the EPA. Seems like Democrats are getting a lot of what they wanted in this bill, even though Republicans control all the branches of government.
Well, the two leaders of the Democratic Party in the House and the Senate immediately went out with celebratory statements last night. We haven't heard anything like that from the Republican leadership. And as you say, there are actual instructions saying you can't spend this money on the wall. So there's a clear defeat there for the president. He punted that off into football season, saying they'll take care of it in the fall. And non-defense domestic spending actually goes up under this bill, even though President Trump has said he would veto any bill that did that. We have seen no veto signal from the White House, and they're actually trumpeting this as something of an achievement. And, you know, the big cut that they wanted to make to the National Institutes of Health didn't happen. The evisceration of the EPA is not in there. They only cut it by 1%. It's a little bit difficult to see how this isn't a victory for the minority Democrats.
Now, Ron, we've been hearing some clips from CBS because Trump gave an interview to John Dickerson. And one of the things that came out today is that that interview ended rather abruptly. Dickerson was pressing President Trump about what he meant when he claimed in a tweet without evidence that President Obama wiretapped his campaign. And this is what happened.
I just wanted to find out, though, you're the president of the United States. You said he was sick and bad because he had tapped
you. You can take it any way you want.
But I'm asking you because you don't want it to be fake news. I want to hear it from President Trump.
You don't have to ask me.
Why not?
Because I have my own opinions. You can have your own opinions.
But I want to know your opinions. You're the president of the United States.
It's enough. Thank you.
That was the end of the interview. What do you make of that, Ron?
President turned and walked away with a gesture. You have to say that there was a point of exasperation there where President Trump thought that he was just ending the interview, and then John Dickerson asked another question and a rather pointed one. There has been a certain amount of suggestion from some of the people in the administration that they'd like to take a look at the limitations on what reporters can do and what is defined as reality in the media. He's going to need the cooperation of Congress and the courts if he wants to change that kind of law. Those kinds of restrictions, the chances of that happening, not very good.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, President Trump has invited Philippine President Duterte to the White House. Trump's chief of staff, Reince Priebus, said a visit would be necessary to deal with North Korea. Well, the Trump administration is applying pressure to countries to help end North Korea's nuclear and missile program, something North Korea has said is a non-starter. And over the weekend, it carried out another failed missile test. But President Trump is sending mixed messages in his own language. Today, he told Bloomberg News he'd be honored to meet with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. But last week, he said there's a chance we could have a major, major conflict with North Korea. What could that possibly look like? John Wolfstahl is a former senior director for arms control at the National Security Council under President Obama. He's now with the Harvard Kennedy School. He joins us now. And John, does this language have experts worried, or is it considered from Trump bluster?
Any normal person would be worried when the president of the United States talks about the possibility of a war with North Korea. There's a reason that every president since Dwight Eisenhower has worked very hard to make sure we don't have another war on the Korean Peninsula because of how devastating it would be. But at the same time, any conflict launched by the United States would have to be first led by a major increase in military capability on the peninsula to protect our allies and our interests. We haven't seen that yet. So I think the talk is loose, but we're not at the point that people are actively worried about a conflict.
Well, and how could you possibly have a conflict? This is a nuclear-armed country. Well, both countries are, but North Korea's leader is considered extremely unstable. How do you have any kind of conflict without triggering him?
I don't think you can. I think the question is multiple-fold. One is, would the U.S. president launch preventive war against North Korea? We saw what happens in Iraq under President Bush when you try to prevent a country from having the capability to hurt you, and that was a country that wasn't nearly as strong as North Korea is. So preventive war could be a disaster. But I think you also have to look at the real risk of accidental conflict or unintended escalation. We have all kinds of problems with North Korea. We have ships that stray into the wrong waters. We have artillery that goes off accidentally. You have individuals that cross the DMZ without permission. And when you're ratcheting up the tension by talking about armadas or the possibility that we might go first, that's going to raise the fear in North Korea that they may have to go first just to prevent us from doing so.
Well, China, South Korea, Japan have all voiced concerns about this accidental provocation. But on the other hand, there are people who point to the fact that under past administrations, North Korea was able to develop nuclear weapons and long-range missiles.
That's true, and it's something that, despite the efforts of both President Obama and his predecessors, we were unable to prevent. Nobody wants to see North Korea with nuclear weapons or missiles, and I think there is a strong argument for increasing the pressure on China, for increasing the pressure on North Korea, but also withstanding with our allies, South Korea and Japan, so that there really is a price to pay by those countries.
Well, pressure to do what?
The goal is to bring North Korea back to the negotiating table. That was explicitly the statement made by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to members of the Senate last week, that our goal is to bring North Korea back into negotiations. And that, I think, is the only way we will ever prevent North Korea from possessing these capabilities through negotiations.
And North Korea has said that is complete non-starter. That is not going to happen. So is there other pressure in, for instance, sanctions to force them to the table? I mean,
yeah. That's correct. The goal here is to put more Chinese skin in the game. So China for a long time has had leverage over North Korea that they've been unwilling to use.
Because you're talking about millions of people coming over the border from North Korea into China.
That's exactly right. And up until now, China has feared North Korean collapse more than American pressure. And I think that's part of what has to change. Chinese banks should be forced to make a decision. Do they want to do business with North Korea or do business in the United States? Chinese shipping firms have to decide. Do they want to do business with North Korea or do business in the United States? We have known for a long time that China needs the United States more than we need China. And up until this point, we have not been willing to put enough of a point on that choice for China.
But what else can be considered? There are genuine concerns about North Korea. We talked, for instance, recently to the Republican Rep. Tom Garrett of Virginia, who says this is what keeps him up at night.
My relatives are calling. They're worried, too. I think any normal person watching the news should be concerned about the possibility of a conflict right now.
But is there a possibility of going in and covertly going in and taking out the leader of North Korea? Or does that then destabilize the region so much? I mean, what might other war planners be looking at?
We tried to do this at the beginning of the Iraq War. We actually struck at one of Saddam Hussein's palaces in 2003, the day before the invasion began, and we missed. We thought we had splendid intelligence, and in fact, we just destroyed a palace, but nobody was in it. So we look at the options, but it's extremely hard to know where everything is. So even if you wanted to target, for example, all of North Korean nuclear weapons, they know that we might want to target them. They don't put them in one place or two places, and they harden them, and they put them underground because they are thinking, how vulnerable are they? At the same time, we're thinking, how can we get at them? There's no way to bomb your way out of this problem. This has to be a negotiated settlement.
That's John Wolfstahl, former senior director for arms control at the National Security Council under former President Barack Obama and now with the Harvard Kennedy School and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. John, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That's Laura Michelle Kelly in the touring production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's The King and I. Kelly won an Olivier Award, that's the British version of a Tony, for playing Mary Poppins in London, a role she then played on Broadway. She's also appeared on Broadway in Finding Neverland and Fiddler on the Roof. We caught her in her current role playing Anna, an English governess who becomes the tutor to the wives and children of the King of Siam. Laura Michelle Kelly, welcome to Here and Now.
I love it here. This is a lovely studio if you're all at home listening.
Compared to your stage that you're on normally?
This is a fancy radio station and compared to some others I have been into.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that because, you know, you're somebody who is at the top of your craft. You've won the Olivier Award for playing Mary Poppins in London. You played it on Broadway. You were a star in Finding Neverland. And now you're touring.
Yeah. Why would I do that?
Why would you tour when you could have be in one place?
Well, that's a really good question. I came out of doing New York thinking, you know, I need a new adventure. But when this show came up, I actually originally wanted to do the Lincoln Center production once Kelly O'Hara left. I was hoping they'd consider me. And I heard that they were in talks, but they rightly offered it to Marin Mazzi, the icon. And so I thought, oh, well, okay, that's that. But then they offered me the tour. So I thought, well, I don't really want to do a tour because I like my home comforts. And I know how hard it is from everyone's stories. And believe me, it is as hard as people say.
Are you living in hotels or what do you do?
No, I'm lucky enough to have to, I have to stay in a little Airbnbs all around the country because my beautiful little companion dog does not like hotels and they do not like him. So I'm actually spoiling him a little and myself, and I'm doing it in apartments all around the nation, which isn't as easy as it sounds. But I love this show, and one of the reasons why I took King and I was because I wanted to work with Bartlett Sher, the most profound Tony Award-winning director, and I was totally right because he's an incredible guy. And
what's so great about him?
He's a very, unlike some directors, he's a very encouraging director. So he brings out the best in you, but also challenges you. He's not like, you trust him to push your boundaries. And he certainly did that with this show. The character was very different from how I'd originally thought her to be. He's just such an instinctive guy. Like, he can tell the very minor details that a lot of people wouldn't notice.
Now, this is not the first time that you've actually played this character either, right?
No, I played it at the Muni at St. Louis, which was also an incredible experience. And I loved it. But I wasn't done with the part, and I knew I'd like to play it again, and that's kind of ignited my passion. And I'm really glad. There was so much more to it that we had time to, you know, explore.
What have you learned about the part this time around that you didn't know last time?
I think that the era that we're in with the political struggles we're having and the two different sides of the nation right now, that was definitely coming across in rehearsals. We've got two different cultures and divisions, and we're trying to bridge those cultures and communicate effectively. You might be on two different sides. It's not easy to come together and help each other see each other's side. And that's exactly what Anna and the King are doing. She was brought in real life. This is a real life story. Anna Leon Owens in 1863, I believe, she got invited by the King of Siam to come in and modernize the country, help modernize the country. But not just that, to teach his children the ways of the world. And there's a lot of, struggles there because they have their myths and their legends and their ways. And she's saying this is wrong. They don't share the same values entirely. And you can't come at another person with saying, this my way is the only way and it's right. You've got to be very careful to come onto someone else's level and be like, okay, how can we work together? How can I help you see my side?
Well, we have gone entirely too far in this interview without hearing some of your voice, some of the singing. And of course, this show is so famous for the music, rightfully so. But maybe you can just give us a little bit of one of the songs.
One of my favorite songs in this show is Shall We Dance? And I'll sing just the introduction.
Yeah.
We've just been introduced. I do not know you well, but when the music started, something drew me to your side. So many men and girls are in each other's arms. It made me think we might be similarly occupied. Shall we dance on a bright cloud of music? Shall we fly? Shall we dance? Shall we then say goodnight and mean goodbye? Oh, for chance. And if you want to hear the rest, you have to watch the show.
You got to watch the show. But when I hear you do that, I just think, God, you were just made for this role.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Is it nice or annoying or what to sing it over and over and over again?
These songs by Rodgers and Hammerstein, that they're incredible. And that's why they keep getting redone again and again and again. No, it's a pleasure to sing these every night. And I think they're a standard for the rest of for our generation to be like, we've got to make musicals as beautiful and as genius as them. And I think, you know, people like Lin-Manuel Miranda created Hamilton. It was breaking the mold and will last a lifetime and more. And that's exactly what they did. And it surpasses time or the years we're in, the era that we're in, because they're dealing with the human condition in all their words. And as I said, this was written in 1952. It was written about 1863. And we're sitting in 2017 and people still want to see it on stage every night. It's exquisite and genius. And heart-opening. And those are the kinds of productions that I want to be part of.
Now, I know that one of the things that's been difficult for you about this particular show is the dress that you have to wear, which weighs 40 pounds?
Yeah, 45. And it takes pounds. Four people to put it on, so like three people now. But Kathy Zuber, she's won. There's no question why she won the Tony for Best Costume Design. The costumes we're all wearing are exquisite, this being one of them. And yes, it's £45, but it looks beautiful and it moves so well. It's so pretty to watch.
Now, I want to hear two pieces of sound here that we have from a different role that you played, Mary Poppins. You were Mary Poppins on Broadway and in London,
yes.
Right? And let's hear first the Mary Poppins that most Americans probably know, which would be Julie Andrews. This is from the 1964 movie.
And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see.
Okay, and then this is you from the London cast recording 2005.
A robin feathering his nest has very little time to rest whilst gathering his bits of twine and twig.
Now, when you did that role, did you watch Julie Andrews or do you want to do things without, you know, watching what other actresses do in those roles? Or what?
I love that you just did that, that you played both of those things. I think my voice has definitely been colored by Julie Andrews. I watched it every day of my youth on Sound of Music. And I met Julie Andrews. I was so nervous when she watched the show. My skirt fell off and I had to sit down the whole scene. Because it was going to come off. I was mortified. I was more nervous about her coming to see me than the Queen when she came and saw me play Eliza in My Fair Lady. I was more nervous about Julie. She's my Queen.
Well, what's the dream role for you? What do you want to do after The King and I?
That's a really good question. I would like to play all of them all over again. I would just really like to be really challenged. And I would really love to prevent some people going through the hardship, the hard lessons that I have, if I could.
What do you mean the hard lessons?
Well, you know, there's times when you feel rejected or alone or, you know, we have to deal with on a daily basis the competition and being sold this fake version that we're supposed to try and be in the public eye, the, you know, the being perfect, coming across perfect all the time. Like, it's just unreal.
Well, on the issue of rejection, that brings us back to where we started, which is when you have had the success that you have had, you still have to go out and audition.
Yeah, or you don't get the auditions because you're at a certain point and you can't – they just think they know what you're capable of now. I've always been terrible at auditions. Give me the material and I'll nail it, or give me the workshop and I'll be awesome. But don't ask me to be judged in front of a panel of 10 people staring at me forgetting the words.
I can't even imagine.
I've never been good at auditions. And I was just saying to the students, like, there's, you know, 101 ways to be great at audition process. I honestly, I've tried all these classes. I hate them. It's that feeling of judgment rather than giving to a crowd. And right. I can't get my head around it. I bomb every time. So luckily I've gained the reputation of that, not purposefully, just showing up and bombing, and they're like, trust us, she can be good.
Yeah, well, and somehow you managed to get these big roles anyway.
Somehow, it's a miracle.
That's Laura Michelle Kelly, who is currently starring in the touring production of The King and I. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here and to talk about King and I, which is one of my favorite shows of all time. So I'm grateful that people come to see it.
Consumer spending in the U.S. is stagnant. That's according to a report from the Commerce Department today. Spending in March was flat for the second month in a row. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and her new podcast, Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So what's going on with consumer spending?
Well, this is kind of interesting because I'm going to give you headline numbers, but then I'm going to do something very sneaky. I'm going to use inflation-adjusted numbers.
Okay.
So the headline looks pretty rotten. Like you said, it looks like the headline spending increase was very small. But when we adjust for the impact of inflation, we call that real spending, the number looks a little bit better. So we're maybe up just by a tenth of a percent. It's up by 0.3%. And if you do the same thing with income, because obviously we make a certain amount of money that we have to pay for stuff then, if we look at the headline number, we see just a 0.2% increase in March from February. But we see the gain was a lot healthier after we take into account that inflation's running pretty low. I will say something kind of funny about the whole report, which is just when everyone thought that Americans were going to be nutty again, the saving rate actually rebounded to a seven-month high of 5.9%.
So you can look at it and say, well, maybe it's not the worst thing people are saving rather than spending.
Right.
But when you take it together with what we just saw last week, the quarterly GDP growth slowing to 0.7%, is there cause for concern?
I don't want to go too nuts. You know, part of the decrease here in the first quarter and in this report is that we have seen a drop in motor vehicle sales. But, you know, we were at near record highs at the end of last year. We also saw some strange, unseasonably warm winter weather. And in the GDP report, that actually depresses the spending that we do on gas and utilities, right? So what I guess is important is the economy expanded by just a 0.7% in the first 3 months of the year. It's the slowest in 3 years. But I also will note that, you know what, for the last 5 or 6 years, average first quarter growth has been really tepid. And then the subsequent 3 quarters, things pick up a little bit. So I think all is not lost. Take a deep breath. We're probably going to see a pickup in growth.
What does all this mean for the Fed, which starts a 2-day meeting tomorrow?
Well, you know, the Fed is going to look at a couple of different trends. So they're going to say, uh-oh, growth did slow down the first couple of months. But I think that the Fed's also going to be happy to see that things were a little bit better in the month of March. Now, we just got even a manufacturing index out today that showed that, you know, things didn't do so hot. But, you know, it looks like there's some acceleration that's beginning coming into the quarter. What does the Fed also want to see? They want to see that there's going to be prices that are increasing. You just heard me say inflation's been pretty low. I think the Fed's going to keep an eye on the inflation target. And most importantly, this Friday, we've got a jobs report that comes out. And if that jobs report shows wage acceleration, I think that puts the Fed on track to keep raising interest rates throughout the year. Probably not going to happen at this meeting this week. It's, you know, but I think in June, we're expecting another quarter point. And what the Fed's trying to do is what they say, normalize interest rates. It's hard to make the case that interest rates need to be at emergency levels of, you know, 1% or so if we're creating enough jobs and wage gains are accelerating.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks so much, as always.
Great to be with you.
The Whole Women's Health Clinic in Austin, Texas recently reopened 3 years after it was closed down, again now offering full gynecological care, including abortion services. The clinic was one of two dozen that closed in Texas after that state passed House Bill 2 in 2013. You probably remember. The law put restrictions on abortion providers, requiring doctors have admitting privileges at a local hospital, and clinics meet standards of ambulatory surgical centers like closet and hallway size. Last June, the Supreme Court struck down those requirements, saying they put an undue burden on a woman's right to have an abortion. But that was too late for many clinics in Texas that shut down for good, which is why many are cheering that this one is reopening in Austin, although anti-abortion activists in Texas say they may have lost this battle but are still winning the long-term war in the state over abortion. Amy Hagstrom-Miller is founder and CEO of Whole Woman's Health. She was a plaintiff in that Supreme Court case, Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt, and she joins us by Skype. So, Amy, you won the Supreme Court battle. You're reopening in Austin. I'm imagining this feels like a victory.
You know, it feels really fantastic to be able to return to offering services. You know, the win that we had last summer was just fantastic on paper. It really set a strong precedent for women and families, not only in Texas, but across the country. But this phase, I think, to my team is even more meaningful because we're actually able to realize the effects of the win on paper and begin to basically reinstate the fabric of care that was really decimated by the law a few years ago.
But as you well know, anti-abortion activists very strong there in Texas are saying they're actually winning the long-term battle here. And Politico seems to agree. They've got a piece out how Texas is beating the Supreme Court on abortion, that Texas has taken what might have happened in a decade in other states and collapsed it into 1 year. And the progress they've made in shutting down clinics. I mean, isn't it true that most of the clinics there that shut down after the state law, before it was overturned by the Supreme Court, they can't reopen?
So I think one of the things that I've learned in the last few years is that just because Texas opposition says it's so doesn't necessarily make it true. And so I think what we've seen with the win that we had in the Supreme Court is a changing of the landscape of abortion rights work across the nation. 10 different states beyond Texas's borders have already used the Whole Woman's win in order to reinstate access in the states, to roll back trap laws, and to make things better for women. And so I think Texas, that's probably pretty hard on the anti-abortion movement in Texas to see that us fighting back actually helped people all over the country. And I think that they have tried to do lots of things since then. They did a little end run game through the administrative process, and they're trying to introduce lots of legislation this time around. That's nothing new. That's nothing different. Well, Texas has been doing that every time the legislature meets since the year 2000.
Well, then that's what people are pointing to, those smaller cuts into the fabric here. This idea that Texas has passed so many of these regulations. You even say that, you know, there are fewer abortion providers in the state. Many women have to travel hundreds of miles to receive care. It's such a vast state. Because of, I mean, name some of the smaller regulations that anti-abortion activists in Texas do say is going to add up to effectively overturning abortion rights.
Exactly. I mean, that's their strategy. They know they can't overturn Roe in the courts. And so they've tried to introduce as many restrictions as they can on the ground, which basically makes abortion legal on paper, but very difficult for people to access. And so HB2 was the omnibus one, you know, that closed, that we went from 44 clinics down to 18. Mm-hmm. But even before that, we have waiting periods, we have forced ultrasounds, we have a ban on Medicaid funding for abortion all throughout the state. We have restrictions on minors' ability to access access abortion, et cetera. And so I think what we've seen, and this isn't only unique to Texas, what we have seen are states introducing regulations specifically targeting abortion as somehow different from other parts of healthcare, and targeting restrictions on abortion providers aimed at shutting clinics down because they know they can't get rid of the right on paper that women have as you know, guaranteed by the Constitution. So they're trying to come up with other ways to basically shut clinics down by any means necessary.
You write in an op-ed in the Dallas News recently that at least 46 anti-abortion bills have been introduced recently. This is at the state level. You talked about waiting periods. So a woman might have to wait 24 hours after getting to a clinic, but if there's nowhere to stay in the area and she's traveled days to get there, that's, in your view, onerous. There's a 30-page form, we understand, to be filled out. Women are asked to look at a video. What's the video?
So women are asked to, well, basically the doctor is forced to describe the ultrasound image to the woman when the doctor does the ultrasound 24 hours before the abortion. It has to be at least 24 hours. And the doctor is mandated to describe the image that's seen in the ultrasound. And the doctor is also mandated to read a script of what we call state mandated information to every single woman one-on-one at least 24 hours before her procedure.
Well, we understand, for instance, as part of that, they're told that an abortion might cause breast cancer, but that's been disproved.
Exactly. And so that is something that the doctors are compelled to read to the patients. And then the doctor, of course, can share real medical evidence that disputes that. But that's a great example, Robin, of one of the things that the whole woman's health decision is going to allow us to overturn. Because basically the Supreme Court ruled in our favor, saying that states can't just insert themselves between a woman's right to access abortion and what exists on paper without substantiating their assertions with medical evidence. Yeah. This is a huge change that happened last summer.
And a federal judge in another case you were involved in also blocked Texas regulations that forced Texas healthcare providers to bury or cremate embryonic or fetal tissue from abortions, miscarriage treatments for ectopic pregnancies, whether or not the patient wanted that. So you have had some victories. What do? Do you take all of these to court, all of the Texas requirements?
You know, that's a great question, Robin. The state filed those restrictions that you just referenced, the embryonic funeral, you know, sort of restrictions, 4 days after we won in the Supreme Court last summer. And so this is a strategy of the opposition to try to tie up our resources in lawsuits. And you know, honestly, it's better for us if we can stop these things at the policy level, if we can stop bills like this from being introduced in the first place. But in places like Texas, when the opposition has the House and has the Senate and has the governor's mansion, the best that we can do is say, hey, we're going to challenge these things in the court system, because just because a woman lives in Texas doesn't mean her rights should be any different for her to access than if she lived in other parts of the country.
But again, Amy Hagstrom-Miller, again, founder and CEO of Whole Women's Health, a group of privately owned women's clinics that provides all gynecological services, including abortion services in Texas. Do you just keep fighting, or is there a point in which you say we are so hardened on each side of this divide? Is there something you can offer to the people in Texas who might want to come over to choice, but there's something holding them back? I mean, they want to know that the woman has been counseled, I mean, which is, you know, outrageous to women who don't want to be talked to about their health decisions. But is there some, I mean, we are so deep in this divide. Is there something that in your camp you're talking about maybe offering to women and men on the other side?
Oh, you know, I come into the work from a human rights and justice framework. I understand the moral and ethical complexity that people face with unplanned pregnancy. In no way am I trying to simplify it as just sort of a rights conversation. And I have instituted some of those kinds of things internally in my office based on what women care about and what women want.
What do you mean? So, like counseling or what?
Yeah, absolutely. And to me, that should be determined upon what the woman needs, not what the state is telling us to do. So if she wants to bring her loved ones into the clinic, if she wants to see her ultrasound, if she wants to have counseling, absolutely. That is part of our compassionate approach to women. However, that's not something that the state should come in and mandate to people any differently in abortion services than other kinds of medical care that people need.
That's Amy Hagstrom-Miller, founder and CEO of Whole Woman's Health. These are privately owned women's clinics that provide gynecological services, including abortion, around the country, including in Texas. And she was able to reopen the Austin, Texas clinic just a few days ago after last year winning that case in the Supreme Court. Amy, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Robin.
And a program note, later today on All Things Considered, Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative. He's been spending a lot of time on death row trying to help prisoners leave it. We'll get his thoughts on the death penalty and where it's headed after last week's news, Arkansas executing 4 men in 8 days. That's later today on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Here and Now. Climbers are mourning the death of renowned mountaineer Uli Steck, who died yesterday while climbing near Mount Everest in Nepal at 40. It's not yet known what happened, but he was known as the Swiss Machine, setting several records for ascending the north face of Eiger, a peak in the Bernese Alps, that he climbed in 2 hours and 47 minutes without a rope. He also completed the first solo climb of the south face of Annapurna in Nepal and was once awarded the Piolet d'Or, basically the Oscar of mountaineering. Steve House is an American professional climber, a peer, and most important, a good friend of Uli Steck. He joins us by Skype from Ridgeway, Colorado. Steve, a loss to the climbing world, but a personal loss for you. So we're so sorry.
Yeah, thank you. He was a great man.
Well, and a great athlete. Tell about some of the things he did. The speed had to do with it, but climbing a whole set of mountains in a certain amount of time. What were some of his accomplishments?
Uli was, I think, it's hard to know even where to begin.
Yeah.
Uli was an incredible athlete, and he brought a level of athleticism to alpinism, which is the term we use for climbing Alps, let's say, climbing mountains as opposed to climbing shorter rock walls or boulders or indoor walls. And within alpinism, you know, you have to be good at everything. You have to be good at rock climbing, ice climbing. You have to understand weather. You have to understand the mountains and their moods and when they're safe and when they're dangerous. And not only did he become really good at that, but he honed his athleticism consciously and consistently for going on 15 years now.
Yeah. Summited Everest without oxygen, traveled between mountains with only on bike or kite.
Oh, he did summer before last, I think, climbed all the 4,000-meter peaks in the Alps, human-powered between them, using his paraglider and a bicycle.
Yeah. He was planning next month to climb part of a route up Mount Everest that had only been successfully completed once. Here is a little bit of him talking about his plans to do that.
I think the chance is there that it's possible, but I don't know. The original Hornbein route has never been repeated since 1963. Nobody was successful to repeat that route. It means this is already quite a challenge.
That's Uli Steck talking about the challenge that lay ahead of him, but he has died on a mountain. And Steve House, you know, is this hard for you?
I'm okay.
Okay. Well, we understand last year it was Uli and a climbing partner who found the bodies of Alex Lowe and David Bridges, who died in Tibet in an avalanche. You know, Lowe, one of the great...
In 1999.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, they died in 1999. Uli found them. Lowe, considered one of the greatest mountaineers of all time. It is a part of this life.
Yes, it is. Despite the fact that we have these incredibly tragic outcomes sometimes, I think that it's worth remembering that their quest that they were on, that Uli was on, is an incredibly beautiful and pure quest for his better self. And that's what the world is missing today. We're missing those stories that he was going to bring back to us, that he was going to tell us over the next 40 or 50 years of his life, that what he found, what he learned about himself, what he learned about his humanity, what he learned about his humility, his ego. You know, he was a man that was under an intense amount of, in the last years, he'd become so well known. He was pursuing this incredibly dangerous and risky thing, yet he was under a lot of public scrutiny.
Yeah, a lot of pressure.
Under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
I think we humans, we create this world around ourselves that we believe we're in control of. And in climbing mountains especially, that certainty doesn't exist. The environment is just too complex, too dynamic to know what's going to happen And eventually, we have to understand as climbers that this can happen to us. There's no escaping that. I've lost so far too many friends, and Uli did as well. He was fully aware that that risk existed. But I think that no matter how hard these lessons are, this is the real world. And I think what we rightly need to do is respect and even enshrine and idolize these people that gave their lives to teach us these things. It teaches us the lessons in a really hard way, but we need to remember them. We need to tell their stories. We need to laugh about them because they're still here. And this is the real world. The real world is actually imperfect and at times dangerous. And that's where we all live.
Yeah. You get to climb among the gods, up towards the gods, but you are not gods. Steve House helping us remember his friend Uli Steck, the renowned professional alpinist who died yesterday near Mount Everest at 40. Steve, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young, along with Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.